Quick update. I'm launching a new course for 2025. It's Foundations of Application Security. It's a two-day bootcamp covering everything you need to become a well-rounded AppSec practitioner. There's both public and private courses available, and the best part about it all is taught by me. So if you're interested, just send me an email, call@galahcyber.com.au, or say hi on LinkedIn if you can have a chat about it.
Sometimes you do work that just becomes what I like to call shelfware, where you're doing a risk assessment or you're doing a document that you know the agency or the organisation isn't really going to use. They're just doing it to tick some sort of compliance box. It's hard to motivate yourself to do that, but if you can be doing something that you know is going to make a difference to the world, I think that helps you get out of bed each morning.
Hi, I'm Cole Cornford, and this is Secured, the podcast that dives deep into the world of application security. I'll be chatting with Australia's top software security experts to uncover insights on the diverse approaches they take to application security. If I ask you to picture a typical cybersecurity professional, you probably won't think of someone who spends all their free time during university playing sports. But of course, people from all kinds of backgrounds find their way into our industry. Trevor Hancock believes his love of sport, particularly team sports like rugby and touch footy, helped him develop skills that have helped him in his decades-long career as a cyber consultant. In our chat, we discuss finding a balance between protecting against security threats while enabling an organization to pursue its goals, the importance of being vulnerable with your colleagues, and plenty more. Whether you're a cybersecurity expert or just starting out in the field, I'm sure you'll find something valuable in our conversation.
Trev, hey, lovely to meet you, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, going really well, thanks. Thanks for your time.
That's all good. So, first question. I ask everybody that comes onto the Secured show, what bird do you most like and why?
Well, I would like to say that I'm like two birds, I reckon. I've got one is I like to say I'm like the emu. My understanding is Australian coat of arms. The reason the kangaroo and the emu are on there is because neither of them can take a backward step. So I like to believe that's me. I like to be always trying to move forward. But realistically, I'd have to say that I'm probably more like a kookaburra because I do like to have a good laugh. I would take two birds, I reckon.
Yeah, that's it. You know, two birds, one stone, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Or one question in this case. So why is it important to you to always be moving forward?
Well, just because you want to be making a difference. If you spend too much time trying to, like, you learn from your mistakes and learn from the past, but it's no use dwelling on it because it's over. If you're going to make a difference, you've got to be looking forward.
Yeah. For myself, I've had like hard times recently and I've had to make some tough decisions. And I think that that's a really good thing to be bringing up yourself, you know, is that, you know, we have to move forward.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that emus and kangaroos don't go backwards. They just don't have a reverse function at all, do they?
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So, anyway, and as I said, it makes it easy when you've had tough times. I have the same. My teenage son went through some depression and we had to work through that as a family. And yeah, it's better to be looking forward than trying to dwell too much on what you've done right or wrong in the past, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to something a bit happier, right? Because you like a laugh as well, hey?
Yeah, so, exactly.
So you got a good bird joke or some kind of something funny, just a story for the listeners?
Well, you might not know, but I love the rugby and I've got to have a bit of fun at the halftime in one of the rugby games recently where I actually got to dress up as a blow-up horse and run around the oval and do an obstacle course at halftime. So that was pretty fun. Bit of a laugh.
Oh, really? Was this for the Raiders?
Or? For the Brumbies, rugby union.
Were you on all fours or?
No, so it was one of those blow-up suits, you know, where you've got a fan and a battery and so the back end of the horse was just blown up air, whereas the front end was my sort of legs and arms.
Oh, yeah. I know what you mean.
It felt a bit weird, but it was funny.
Did you fall over at all?
No, but I knocked the battery out of the fan, so my bottom deflated. So by the end of it, I looked like a bit of a sick and sorry horse.
A very sad, lame one without back legs.
Yeah, exactly. As if someone had taken me out. Yeah,
reverse centaur in this case, right? Oh, yes. Dear. All right. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, I'm always up for a good laugh, so... One of the things that we're going to be doing is diving into people's careers. So
yep.
I'd like to start with what's one of the most interesting or exciting projects that you've worked on and always engaging about it for you?
So it's sort of a toss-up for me is because, like, especially now at the more senior part of my career as I'm sort of hopefully coming towards the end of it, getting closer to retirement than my starting time. I'm looking for something that where I feel like I'm making a difference. So I've sort of got three projects that I've been really lucky to work on recently, where one, I was working on a cyber threat intelligence sharing capability, which had a goal of not only uplifting the individual organisation, but uplifting the cybersecurity resilience of the whole of Australia's economy. So that was pretty exciting to be working on that. And then also, I worked within a government department to implement the identity solution that Australian citizens use to engage with government. That's pretty exciting to know that you're making a difference to people like your mum and dad and your family. And then I guess the last one is helping some state government agencies develop their whole of government cybersecurity strategy. So helping a government for a state define what their strategy is going to be for the next 4 or 5 years. So they're what sort of keeps me up and gets me excited about my job, is that ability to be making a difference.
I really like that idea of making a difference. One of the things to myself is that I don't know when it's going to be, but at some point in the future, I'll be finishing up with Galah Cyber. And I don't know when that's going to be. I don't know what that looks like or why that's going to be the case. Maybe someone comes up to me and acquires me with a fat stack of money.
That'd be nice.
Maybe I just get sick of AppSec. I don't know. But ultimately, when I do finish up, one of the things I do really want to be given back is making a difference to the Australian community. And I thought that one part way to do that was to really just go hard at working in the public sector, just really getting into it. I don't mind as a consultant or as a permanent staff member, but just like really working on projects and make a difference to the sovereign cybersecurity capability of Australia. Hopefully I can help with that a little bit.
Yeah. No, and that's the thing is like we all work in cybersecurity and there's so many varying areas that you can work in the field. And sometimes you do work that just becomes what I like to call shelfware, where you're doing a risk assessment or you're doing a document that you know the agency or the organisation isn't really going to use. They're just doing it to tick some sort of compliance box. It's hard to motivate yourself to do that, but if you can be doing something that you know is going to make a difference to the world, I think that helps you get out of bed each morning.
Yeah, and I think that's like, I noticed that cybersecurity has a lot more people who are jaded than other disciplines. Within tech, at least, because I work very closely with architects, with engineers, with UX testers who are still quite passionate about technology and their jobs. And I think that a lot of time it's because they get to really see the impact that they're making on a day-to-day basis by interacting with customers and just seeing what their changes go live. And I feel like a lot of the work that we do with cybersecurity is preventative, and we get quite abstracted away from our customers at the end of the day, who, you know, you could say, yeah, it's a bank's customers are just people, but if you're doing risk assessments for a bank, you're not really one-to-one, you know, ever interacting with the clients themselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. But also the thing as well, I think our industry makes a bit of a rod for its own back, because we all have to use the fear factor to generate money and generate budgets, because it's only just really recently been a board focus for organisations where cybersecurity is seen as something. It's always sort of been an add-on, as something that is added on to the end rather than in bind. But I think a lot of that is, as you mentioned, aside from being jaded, we've got a lot of naysayers in our industry where they want to just say, no, you can't do that because the risk is too high. But my view on cybersecurity is that you have to be enabling business. If a business can't work, then they can't make money, so they can't pay your salary as a cybersecurity professional for that organisation. So you've got to be willing to help the organisation understand risk and manage it, rather than being the type of person that says, no, it's too risky to do anything.
One of the things from one of my earlier episodes, what Toby said, was getting to yes. And I think that it's such a different attitude and paradigm than what most cybersecurity professionals are taught. So how do we get people to get on that journey to go away from fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and instead just be working with people as a trusted partner to help them get there?
You've got to be willing to share your expertise, like if you've got the thing, but rather than sharing it in a way that say, look, you can't do this because of this is going to happen, and they're all bad, and they're all going to be detrimental to the organization, then you need to be focusing on, all right, if that's going to be detrimental, what can you do to mitigate it? And then it's about converting that narrative to make it about, all right, yeah, there are those risks, but if we do these little things extra on top of what you want to do, then we can still do it and manage that risk. So I guess that's my take out of it, is you've got to be willing to analyze risk. And I think people fear risk, especially cybersecurity professionals who may not be strong in risk. They may know the technical controls, but they don't understand the risks. So they're not very good at presenting risk.
I think also a lot of people really focus on, again, the technical stuff. So we find a cross-site scripting vulnerability, or we find an insecure network port. But then being able to turn that into what does this actually mean for a business is quite hard, because it requires you to have knowledge outside of your domain, right?
Yep.
You need to know how are they making revenue? Like, what keeps their CEO up at night? Is it going to be a ransomware attack? Is it going to be theft of her IP? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess that's why we read the paper, right?
and to be honest, as you mentioned, look, most cybersecurity professionals have a level of technical capability and background, but most users probably don't. So it's getting that balance right between that knowledge of technology and lack of knowledge of technology. So if you don't design your security controls with that in mind, then you're always going to be making it harder and less usable. And to be honest, that's just as big of a security vulnerability as having no security controls. Is people will find a way. They'll find a way to get around your security if it's stopping them but doing what they need to do their job.
Yeah, I think that within, I guess, like my discipline, there's a lot of fail fast and make mistakes and recover from those quickly, because the consequences of making a mistake in software are usually pretty small.
Yep.
In that you can usually iterate on them really quickly. Whereas I feel like for a lot of other projects at work, if you mess up cybersecurity really early on, it's going to be there. Like, those kind of risks will be endemic for the entire project and difficult to fix, right?
Yeah, and that's the big problem with thing. And that's where the concept of, you know, like the app dev process and security by design getting flown into that DevSecOps rather than DevOps processes, is if you can get the security people working with your developers who are developing the capability at the start, then yeah, the chances of having a vulnerable system at the end is a lot less. But to be honest, even today, you'll find, I was on a customer site the other week where a project had been in development for 6 months before they even engaged with security. And so it's still happening today, that lack of engagement and seeing that cybersecurity is an add-on rather than a part of the foundation of the system that's being built.
Yeah. Oh, I wonder how we go about solving that. Do you have any ideas about how do we change that perception?
It's one of those, it's got to be changed from both ends. Security people have to be more open to supporting and being willing to, as I mentioned, take that risk view and say, all right, well, we can't do that, or it's too expensive to do that. So we'll try and do these other mitigations or develop policies or procedures to mitigate it rather than having technical controls. And then in reverse, projects have to be given the breadth to engage a security resource at the start, which is always hard, because most projects are scoped very thin because there's always limited budget or limited time. So having the breadth of capability, but I think everyone needs to own it. And if everyone's owning it and we have that view that security is everyone's problem and it's not just the cybersecurity team's problem to fix it, then I think we'll get there eventually.
It's always about that shared responsibility.
Yeah, exactly.
So shifting gears, you've been in cybersecurity for a quite long time. So can you want to tell our audience your story about how you got into it?
I sort of got a bit lucky. I left university and joined a small consulting organization, and I was a Unix admin. And on my third day, I was dumped out on site, not alone. Like it was a really good company. They gave me both a mentor, and I was working on site alongside an experienced Unix administrator. And then over time, they gave me the training and the on-site skills knowledge transfer so that I was able to step in to become that Unix administrator for that site. And so I developed my career that way. And I got a foundation in technical knowledge. So I did that for my first couple of years. And then we got acquired by a product company, and the product company had a single sign-on solution, and they wanted a volunteer to learn from an expert they're bringing in from the US. And so I said, yep, I'll do it. So I moved to Sydney and worked with this expert and became the product expert in single sign-on. And then that expanded into other of the security products that the organization had. And then we got acquired by another company, a bigger fish bought us. So I then had a wider range of security products that I had to skill up in. And so I became a directory expert, working with X500 directories and LDAP directories for the region. So I would fly over to the US or the UK and get trained up on the company's products. And then I would train the locals. So I'd go into Asia and New Zealand and all around Australia, training our security professionals on the products. And yeah, so then from there, I got poached and joined a PKI company. So as I said, I sort of just stumbled along the way into different product skills. And then from there, after doing PKI, I then moved into a consulting organization that had no products and was doing risk assessments and risk management. And then that led me down the path of learning about the ISM, or the Information Security Manual, here in Australian government. And I was part of the inaugural IRAP program that the Australian government put out to certify Australian government systems. I got involved in that for a couple of years. And yeah, so as I said, I sort of stumbled into it rather than planned it.
Sounds like a lot of your career has been like, well, besides luck from being acquired multiple times and then having your role change, is just saying yes to opportunities and trying new things out. Is that the advice that you would give to new people who are starting in the industry, just being open-minded and saying yes?
Yeah, and to add to that, yeah, definitely. It's being open-minded and be willing to say anything, but also be true and maintain a level of integrity. Like I don't ever claim I know everything, and I don't think I'll ever know everything, but the thing that the clients that I work with like is that I'll go, yeah, I don't know that, but give me a chance and I'll go and find out for you. So you take ownership of a problem, but you're willing to say, I don't know, but I'm willing to find out for you.
I think that builds trust.
So saying yes, but being willing to, yeah, exactly, build trust.
I've met a lot of people who seem to think that they know everything. Then it collapses a little bit later when it's proven that they don't.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they've broken that bridge, right? So how do they build it again? It's very hard to.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of those things, is that doesn't take much to lose trust, but it will take forever to regain it if you do lose it. Having integrity is important. Like I actually got fired from one of my jobs because of that exact reason. We had an opportunity where the sales guy had an opportunity, and so he came to me as the technical lead on the opportunity and said, oh, what would we need to do this? So I said, all right, well, I need all this preparation time to do it. He then went and sold it without taking my advice on. And then so we won it, and then I said, all right, well, if we're going to deliver it, I need this time to do this preparation. And then basically the week before it was supposed to be delivered, he's gone, I need you to go and deliver this. And I said, I can't. I said, I haven't done the preparation, and we don't have the preparation there. We can't. It won't deliver what the customer's expecting. So it will just be a bad experience for me. It'll be a bad experience for the customer, and it'll be damaging to our reputation. They tried to get a contractor in to do it, and they ended up not being able to deliver it because the contractor couldn't deliver it. So I got let go. I got brought into my boss's office and said, look, my contract said that I was to do any legal request asked of me. And I said no to this. So they let me go.
Wow, that's a bit harsh.
But I was comfortable with being let go because I maintained my personal integrity.
I think that's very important to maintain those values. One of the things I try to live through my company is my personal values of, I believe cybersecurity needs to be approachable. It needs to be easygoing and fun. And I know that at least I want to have high quality business driven outcomes for people instead of just focusing on technology and, you know, crazy stuff. And I also know where my skills stop. I'm not a great risk person. I'm not a pen tester. I can't do that really well. But what I am good at is helping software engineers with problems, right? So someone comes to me and says, my system has these kind of architectural constraints. How do I get to yes? Then I can give them some good advice. But like if someone asks me to do an audit against the Essential 8, then I'm going to have a bit of a laugh and try to find a contractor to do it.
That's the thing as well, is that I'm the same. Like I don't claim to know everything. So I'll be happy to grab someone that has more knowledge. But I like to use as an example that you don't cross a busy road without looking left or right. So that is risk management. If you walked out on the road without looking, then you have no risk management approach. But if you actually look left or right before you cross the street, then you are taking a risk management approach. It's just having that mindset that says, what am I trying to do? What do I have to protect against? And then trying to design a way. So I'm sure that with the tips, you could probably do an Essential 8 assessment and control. I'm confident, Cole.
I probably would, but I wouldn't be an expert at it. But at the very least, I'd know how to like start with it. So I've always kind of had that attitude ingrained with myself in my, like, I guess growing up even. So when I was younger, I remember one of my teachers in year seven, so, you know, 20-ish years ago or more for me, was talking about risk management in relation to sports, you know?
Yep.
So don't go tackle the guy who's a foot taller than you and built very strongly, PG show. So, you know, I was going to say.
Yep.
But the main thing is that you don't do that. Don't pick fights that you're going to lose. Don't jump over like pits. Think about risk. Think about it. And that changed a lot of my attitude. And even when I was growing up, I used to play a lot of competitive games, right? And a hell of a lot of that is judgment calls about risk.
Yep.
Because you're like, do I go and engage someone who is better at deathmatch than I am? Or do I choose to wait for a better opportune moment wherein he's distracted, or I have a partner to work with me to fight that person, right?
Yeah.
And so you make these decisions a lot, and I feel like that's really helped me in my career. Like I try to understand the situation that people are operating within, and having like that situational awareness makes you a lot better at being able to make calculated risks. And yeah, cyber's all about that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing you want to add to that, like from a cybersecurity perspective, is that concept that, as you said, you can't know everything. So I see my role as working with, whether it's the network operations team or the app development team or the policy writing team, to go, all right, so what are we trying to do? And my view is to make them aware of the risks. And then I might be a glass half full type of guy, but I personally believe that everyone does care about what they do to some extent. And so no one deliberately develops an application that has security vulnerabilities in it. They are trying to make it as secure as they can. It's just sometimes they need help to understand what the risks are they're trying to mitigate. But I won't know how to do that from an app development perspective. All I'll know is I'll say, look, these are what we're worried about. And then hopefully the app developer can go, well, this is how we would stop you being worried about that. And together we solve the problem.
Delegation is really important. Everyone else is an expert in their areas. I feel like a lot of cybersecurity, you understand security principles extremely well. You understand risk reasonably well in business context. Okay.
Yep.
But the thing that you probably don't understand is whatever people you're interacting with discipline as well as they do. I know I've spoken with people who are absolutely gun at Ruby on Rails, or they're expert Elixir developers, great enterprise architects thinking about how to combine all these systems together in a secure way. They're far smarter than I in those kind of areas. But what I can do is at least communicate to them that these are the kind of things that we are worried about. How are we going to work together to solve that problem?
Yep.
And that usually ends up doing pretty well for me.
Yeah, and that's the right approach, Cole. I 100% agree. It's got to be a collaboration. We can't do it in isolation.
Yeah. So looking back on your career, did you think you'd be in the position you're in today?
Depends how far back you look. When I was at university, I loved my sport. I played rugby, I played touch football. I'd basically have some level of sport on every day of the week bar Friday. I would have, whether it was touch football, rugby training, rugby on Saturday, touch football on Sunday. And I even almost changed careers. I was working part-time while studying at the university gym, and I applied to be a full-time role as a sports facilities officer there, with my thoughts is if they had have got that full-time role, I was going to go back and study part-time to get a degree in sports admin. So, no, I didn't. Definitely didn't think I'd be there.
Do you find that playing all that sport's been helpful for you? Because I feel like sport would give you, like, you'd be really switched on and good at making decisions quickly. What other benefits come from just, like, having a career that started out in sport?
Yeah, you're 100% right. I think probably the biggest one I think that sports helped me is that team approach. As I said, I don't feel as an individual. I think I work better in a team. Now, I've got expertise and I can deliver as an individual, but I get more enjoyment out of any project where I'm working as part of a team. So that sort of team area is really good. So if you've got that ability to work into a team, because like a sports team, like any work team, is that you're going to have the personalities that are really out there. You're going to have the personalities that are a bit shyer but may have some real high quality capabilities that you've got to work out how to draw them out to get the best out of the team. But also, like, going back to your question, once I got into consulting, I think that my career has progressed sort of the way I wouldn't have changed it if I could go back anyway. I think that I've had the capability to change and do multiple things, which has really given me a depth of capability across a lot of areas that have allowed me to really enjoy what I mentioned about the exciting projects that I get involved in. It's because of that capability. Is like my management know that they can throw me on absolutely anything and I will succeed because of that spread of capabilities that I've had involvement in.
I love that sports set you up for success. I know a fair few people in cyber who just like come from, you know, go to university, study a computer science degree, graduate and straight into a techie programming role or something. And so hearing people with diverse stories and ways that they get into this field is awesome to me, because I actually know a few other people who've come from competitive sports. One of my favorite guys used to be a Wallabies player and now does sales. So
nice.
As he was said, he was told, yeah, you're going to be on the bench permanently at Parramatta.
Yep.
And he said, well, rather than being a bench warmer for my career, I'm going to go learn how to do marketing and sales. So, and that's what he did, and he's transitioned into that.
Yeah, nice.
But he still enjoys playing his sport, right? So.
Yeah, and that's right. And to be honest, like I've got a good mate that is an ex-Brumby, an ex-Wallaby, who's now working for a competitor, but working in a similar industry to me, and it's purely based on the high performance areas that he learnt through being a professional sports person that he's now transitioned into helping teams operate in high performance mode, which I think is a great analogy that you have to do that. So
yeah,
and you need something, whether it's the sport or whether it's just the exercise or then you've got to have that thing where you're actually keeping your body moving as well as your mind.
Yeah, that's something I let drop a lot, actually, myself. I need to really hit the gym, so.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm trying to get back to my running. I was running a bit. So I'm trying to get back to it. It was funny. I rang one of my partners from the company I work at because I was running every day. As I said, flexibility of my job meant that rather than having a lunch break, I'd just go at whatever time I didn't have meetings. But he loved it because I'd ring him in the middle of it going, I want to run, and I've had this idea. And we'd just talk about my idea as I was running. So it frees your mind. Exercise is good for that.
Yeah, like I find that as well. At least when I get stuck, like, you know, so I do code reviews a fair bit, right?
Yep.
And a lot of it gets monotonous because you've just been staring at an IDE with like extreme focus, because you're basically doing taint analysis and it's really hard to do that consistently for a long sustained period of time. even with coffee. So what you do is you get up and you go pick your baby up and carry her around the house and tell her that she's a cute dum-dum.
Yeah.
And then go for a walk outside, play fetch with the dog. I think that sunlight is really good way to kind of reset and get a different view on things, or just like talking through stuff with your partners, with your friends. I need to spend more time doing that personally, because like when I do get into a bit of a rut from just having to work really long hours, I find that reset really helps me.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because you bury yourself sometimes in your work because you get such a heavy workload that you think, oh, I can't take a break. I need to be working. But you realize the longer you work and the longer you go without that break, the less percentage of quality work you get out. And so eventually you get a negative effect because you're spending more time sitting there. Whereas if you took a half hour break and came back, you'd probably deliver more than just sitting there trying to deliver.
I do notice that. My eyes glaze over and I'm just like scrolling through a file and I'm like, wait a second. I'm picking up that I'm just like kind of going through the motions, but not being effective at this point, right?
Yeah.
So better get that exercise band out and start like doing those things, you know, just behind your back, pull it, get your spine moving.
The same when you do quality assurance on documents and stuff, because I deliberately will mark in a different color when I'm editing, so just so that I can see that I've done a good edit on it, and then of course convert it back to the real color. But yeah, if I notice there's a page where there's been no color change, and I think, oh, I need a break because I'm not really reading this.
Yeah, so do you redline everything?
Yeah, sort of that. I highlight if I'm changing something. So like I'm tend to work in IT, so you don't sort of redline as much, but I do the track changes so that it is actually highlighting the changes that I'm making.
Yeah, one of the things that I try to do with my consulting reports from my staff members and also myself is to literally print out the report and then just go through, read it out loud with a blue or red pen and just circle areas that just don't make sense or just are too complicated or too long and that I need to simplify. Because like I feel like that's one of the best artifacts you can be producing in cyber at the moment, at least in my view, is extremely simple, blunt, and informative advice.
Because it's typical of everything. No one has time to read too much detail. It's like when you're in consulting, as you know, you've got to have that executive summary that is to the point, because you know that the executive's not going to read past that summary.
Yeah. Switching gears. So there's a lot of young people who listen to my podcast who are aspiring to get into careers in cybersecurity.
Yep.
What would you recommend that they do to get themselves prepared to join the sector?
I guess to me, the idea is, as I mentioned, you have to be flexible. You have to be willing to try something. I found through my career that I've learned more through failure or trial and error rather than failure, where I've tried something and it's not worked and then worked out the way to get it to work than actually not trying or trying to read and trying to get the right answer before I even start. I think that's one of the things I said, be willing to try. It's one of the things I put in place now with graduates and analysts that joined the company I work for, is the first thing I'll say is I want you to try it. I don't care if you're way off the mark, because I can work with you to understand your thinking and help you because you've had a try. Nothing frustrates me more than when you get a young person on a project and they come up and they go, so how do I do this? 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 And then you're going, well, I could have just done it myself in the time with the number of questions you asked. So that's sort of the approach, is give it a go. Don't be afraid to give it a go. And that would be the first thing. And then the second thing is don't be afraid to ask for help and say, I don't know. IT in general is changing. Like back when I first started, like you had your Unix admin, you had your database admin, you had your network admin, and you sort of, they were your core competencies. But there's just so many competencies now in across IT and even in the specialty of cybersecurity, that you can be a pen tester, you can be a risk a GRC person, you can be a threat intelligence or a threat analyst or a threat hunter. So there's so many different choices. So don't be afraid to say, I don't know. But if you do say, I don't know, be willing to go and find out.
I think that's a great piece of advice. I remember a talk at B-Sides Canberra a few years ago from Alex from Atlassian. And one of the things that they mentioned was that as babies and kids, we like to just learn by doing.
Yep.
So we got really good at computers by just pushing buttons randomly and seeing what would happen. And then as adults, we start to get this risk-averse mindset saying, oh, but what if I do it wrong? What are the consequences? You know, it could be really bad for me. And I think that advice that you give about giving stuff a real, you know, a red-hot go as a graduate is great because, like, what are the consequences, right? I don't think anyone's going to fire you for just writing a report that's wrong.
No.
Ultimately, it's not their fault. It's their managers. And eventually goes all the way up to the top to the business owner. So it's low stakes. Give it a go. And as long as you learn from it, it's all good, right?
And also you can add, like, I had a scenario where I was doing, or I had a team developing a risk assessment for a government agency. And one of the analysts, I did that approach with them and they came up with a risk that I didn't even think of. I went, wow, that's a real risk. We probably should be mitigating that risk, but it didn't even pop into my head. They just because they had that mindset and that was based on their life experience that they saw this potential risk with the system that we were using, and we wouldn't have got that if they weren't willing to share and get involved. So
yeah, really, really like the young folks with all the, you know, there's new perspectives about approaching things. I feel like I have a mindset that's come around from, you know, like for me, playing computer games as a kid, doing long distance running,
yep,
not being particularly good at schooling, but finding ways to be lazy to pass. So having a very programmer mindset to approaching it, right? What's the quickest way to get a pass so I can spend more time playing games, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
yep.
But, you know, that's why I think diversity in your team is really good. So you have people who can view things very differently. And I'm hoping that in the future that we can encourage people from all sorts of backgrounds to come in, especially for this podcast, right?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's move on to the fast segment. So these questions here, I want you to answer with immediately whatever comes into your head, okay?
Yep, sounds good.
Here we go. All right, so best purchase under $100 and why?
Probably I'd have to say Catan.
Yeah, Catan?
It was a board game that it was the start of my family, so my teenage boys and my wife are getting together and playing games together.
Yeah, it's like I always like Settlers of Catan. My university has this habit of getting students in third year computer science to actually have to, similar to Tower of Hanoi, to work out the best decisions matrix for Settlers of Catan based on probability. So we end up with anyone in Newcastle generally hating Settlers of Catan because they had to do an assignment on it. But I didn't do that assignment. I just like accepted that I had enough marks in the subject to get by. So I just didn't hand anything in. So for me, I actually love Settlers of Catan. I don't have any negative attitude around it. So like a sheep for wood for stone kind of guy?
I'm hopeless because my family don't trade with me, so I never win because they always trade with each other before they trade with me because they don't like Dan winning.
It's we had a period of time where my friends, we used to play Risk.
Yep.
I played with some friends who were a couple and they would always like never do anything that would influence the other one to lose. So they'd intentionally make bad risk decisions, but it ended up being with one of them winning because they basically had to double the amount of starting pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
We ended up not playing Risk with them after a few months because they were just like, we're sick of this like couple warfare going on.
Yeah, exactly. I'm the same with when I played the families that if they're going to do something bad, my boys will do it to me over mum. So mum never gets hit if they've got to do something. But if they're going to steal a piece or steal a card because the robbers come along, they're going to choose me or over mum anytime.
So going on to the next question, if you could go to the same holiday destination every time, where would that be and why?
I have to be Fiji. I love the beach, I love scuba diving, and I love warm weather. And Fiji has this in spades and are generally the nicest people.
Yeah, I've never been to Fiji. I know that one of my friends nearly got scammed by wood. Like, you're not supposed to, you can't bring wood back to Australia or something. I remember that was.
Oh, you gotta declare it. If it's got bugs or anything in it, then they'll confiscate it. But if you declare it, they check it and they check for holes for bugs coming into it. I bought in once when I went to Fiji, bought back for my young boys a bow and arrow that got confiscated because I didn't realize because it was deemed a weapon. I've got, it's a kid's toy.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought about that. I would have just been like, oh, look at this. This is good for the kids. And they're like, no.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't do that, man. Or you're like, this is art. It's going to hang on the wall.
Exactly.
And they're like,
no.
Yeah, nah, sorry, mate. Yeah, this isn't going to fly. That brings us up to the end of the interview. I ask all my guests at the very end, what's the one piece of advice that you'd give to our listeners that people normally wouldn't think of as security advice to help keep themselves and their businesses secured?
Oh, that's a tough question. I guess for me, it's don't be afraid to be vulnerable. I don't know, that really sounds stupid when you think of it, security vulnerabilities, but the thing with me is that if you're not afraid to be vulnerable, then you'll share your concerns with others, because I think collaboration is the key to maintaining a secure environment. If you're willing to share what's keeping you up at night and learn from others and let others learn from you, I think that will make us and our Australian businesses more secure.
I think vulnerability is it's a really good quality that I like looking for in staff members as well, because, and it's something that as often as men, we're taught that we need to, like, you know, maintain a position of strength and not really show that we have weaknesses. And so it's often difficult and there's miscommunication. People don't really understand the extent of where cybersecurity issues are because they don't want to look stupid. They don't want to look like they've made mistakes. So I think that's always served me well, and it's good. I'm glad to hear someone else call out vulnerability as an issue, as a thing that you need to do too.
Yep. Thanks for your time, Carl. That was good.
All right. Thanks, Trev, for coming along. It was really good to speak with you, mate. So do you have any shout outs or anything you'd like to say at the end?
No, as I said, it's great chatting to you. I'm glad to see that we're trying to get more people interested in talking about cybersecurity. So definitely happy to be involved.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Secured. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Don't forget to follow the podcast on your favorite platform and leave us a review. Want some more content like the above? Why not subscribe to our newsletter at galahcyber.com.au/newsletter and get high quality AppSec content straight to your mailbox. Stay safe, stay secure, and we'll see you next episode.
If you're new to the show or a seasoned veteran, I want to hear from you. I'm always looking to do better as a podcast host and as a person. So tell me about what I can do better. Tell me about the types of people you want on my podcast. Tell me about if the format's working for you or styles need to be switched up. Do I need to interview differently? So on and so forth. I appreciate you sticking with me for almost 30 episodes at this stage. And I hope I can keep learning and you can keep learning and being entertained for many more episodes to come. So please shoot me feedback. I want the good, the bad, and the ugly to pod@galahcyber.com.au. And if you don't like email, hit me up on LinkedIn.